Welcome to Passy Muir's CAM Podcast, Conversations on Aerodigestive Management. This episode of CAM features your host, Dr. Kristen King, and guest, Dr. Teresa Hopkins-Rasabi, having a conversation on student training and skills for trach and vent.
So I want to welcome everyone to another episode of Conversations on Aerodigestive Management, the CAM Podcast. Today, I'm excited to have with me Dr. Teresa Hopkins-Rasabi, who is an assistant professor at the Medical University of South Carolina in the Division of Speech-Language Pathology. However, she is a certified speech-language pathologist with over 35 years of clinical experience in the acute care setting, or primarily the acute care setting. She has a focus on swallowing and swallowing disorders. She's board certified in swallowing and swallowing disorders. And in completing her PhD, her research focused on respiratory swallow coordination. And today I have her coming in to talk with me about speech language pathology and the program itself, competencies, how students can be prepared to work in a medical setting. But first, thank you again for joining me. And is there anything you want to add about yourself or your background?
No, I think you've done an amazing introduction. So thank you. The only thing I might add is that one of the reasons I'm so interested in speech pathology with trachs and vents and speaking valves is because of, you know, my clinical experience, but also I was very active on a trach team in an acute care hospital and really enjoyed that experience and really felt like it was so important for the patients to and the medical team to facilitate good care of people that had trachs.
Well, you are bringing up a very valid point, and there's research even that supports the impact of a tracheostomy team on the care of those patients and how it really progresses them more quickly. Helps with the whole weaning process and just them achieving and recovering faster than patients who are not with a tracheostomy team. Really has a number of benefits. So I'm glad you mentioned that you actually practiced on a tracheostomy team, because we are going to focus a little bit today, I think, on how students can actually become prepared to work in that medical setting and to have and get exposure and experience with patient populations that they may not typically think of getting when they're in graduate school. So I think a good place to start is, you know, why is that important? Why is it important to have like a trach vent course in a program and have students get that introduction before they're out in the real world?
Yeah. So let me kind of back up with how we got there within our program. So I had the unique and really amazing opportunity to be a part of the startup of the master's program at Medical University of South Carolina. So they had a master's program some period of time ago. It did close. And then Dr. Heather Bonilla was a facilitator of reintroducing this program. We currently have an amazing director, Christina Pilotti, that is kind of leading our charge. But we started with a small faculty. And the vision was, because we're attached to a medical university, to provide a master's program that focused on the SLP that practices in a medical setting. We also have and focus on SLPs that will go out and work in outpatient settings, in schools. We do the whole curriculum, but we do have a particular interest in the medical SLP. And what we did was, and this is really kind of unique and kind of unbelievable, but we have all 40 or 41 of our cohort on their first semester of their first year of their master's, all 40 of them, their clinical rotation is in an acute care setting.
Oh,
and
wow.
This is really unique. And so the first year that we did this, so we're on cohort 3 coming up this fall or in August. The first year we did this, we just matched all 40 of our students with this amazing group of SLPs from MUHA, or the Medical University of South Carolina Hospital System. And in some situations, we matched them 2-1. So two students to a single SLP, they're just trying to get their feet wet. They're just trying to learn about an acute care setting and what they'll be exposed to. So some of it is just kind of being in the environment, and some of it is learning to do the basic skills in that environment, which is a pretty intense environment. And what we saw was that our students were pretty much immediately being exposed to trach and vents patients because the SLPs that they were working with had these patients on their caseload. So we had originally planned for the trach and vents, and I taught it the first 2 years when they were in their second year, because we felt like it was a more intensive course in terms of anatomy and physiology and understanding that, and felt like it was a lot for them to take on while they were in the clinical setting. But then this coming year, we realized, let's rethink that. And this is one of the most fascinating things for me as a faculty member of this program is we sit in a room and make these decisions, and we make these decisions for the benefit of the SLPs that we are training. So we said, what could we do a better job at any moment in this process? And we sat down and said, what if we put the trachs and vents class in their first semester while they're seeing this? And answer some of these questions, because many of these students go into this kind of setting and are just kind of like, oh, what is that? And they ask their clinical supervisor, and of course their clinical supervisor gives them a lot of information, but many times students need to hear it more than once, and they need a safe place, and not that the clinic isn't, but a classroom where the stakes are much lower and they can ask a question and they have the someone in the room, their instructor saying, I'm going to focus on this content so you really understand it. So now we feel like that's going to be a pairing. But what we're doing, since it's a one credit course, is I'm going to teach it to the first years in the second half of the semester. Let them get in, let them get some knowledge, because they also take swallowing, neurogenic language, cognitive communication, like TBI. So I want them to kind of trying to master all that content before we throw trachs at them. But I want them to learn the content while they're exposed to it, so they come back to the classroom with really inquiring minds about what did that mean? Why did they do that? So that's why we're trying to kind of change that content. I could also say that one of the things that's really unique about our program is we really try and focus on competency-based. So we're not just standing up in the room and lecturing the students. We're designing our courses, and this is a process that takes a little while to put in place, to testing the students' knowledge, not just with multiple choice questions and those kind of standard and familiar tests and summative tests. We want them to be able to demonstrate a clinical skill that they'll need when they're out working. Now, they're not going to do it at the level that an SLP with experience can, but they need to have the primary components of that skill in order to layer new knowledge on it. So for this vents and trachs class, one thing I do is one of their assignments is to actually go through a passing mirror evaluation on a case study. We do it in a group setting in the class. They have the criteria. I set up a case study. Maybe a step is missing. How do they think through that? And then they do that as a group where they can ask each other, is that right? Is this right? And then I do it as an individual exercise where they have to write it out so I can see their thought process of why that step was needed, or why if you miss that, that's critical. And I feel like I'll keep modifying that, but I feel like that has focused the students, and I've gotten some excellent feedback from the students that they really felt like that helped them understand why this content was so important.
I think any kind of hands-on and direct application of the information is beneficial, you know, versus just hearing lecture, you know, like mm-hmm. you're saying, having them work through the steps themselves. That active learning process can be really helpful. One of the things I heard, though, am I hearing it correctly, that your students go on placements the very first semester that they're in the graduate program?
Yes. Okay.
So that's a little unusual.
This is a very unique model and not the easiest to conduct. So we have an amazing director of clinical education, Lorianne Ferraro, who just actually finished her PhD as well. She does an amazing job of, it's like climbing a mountain every semester. You know, you have 40 to 41 students and you have about 9 to 11 SLPs that you're going to place all these students with. Well, actually, you know, we use a variety of settings, but the idea that you're going to take these students that are just walking into a program and you're going to teach, you're going to put them in an acute care setting with everything from, you know, just your typical patient that maybe has mild swallowing problems or just had a minor stroke, all the way to a complex TBI patient that's in an ICU on a ventilator. They're going to see all of that. And so what the first year we did this, we got some excellent feedback from the SLPs that take these students on. And they were like, okay, we need a little bit more prep. So the second year, what we did is instead of the first week being, I'm going to lecture to you about anatomy and I'm going to lecture to you about the basis of neurogenic language disorders, instead, what we did was we have a week, we kind of unofficially call it our boot camp, but instead of saying to the students, listen, all this content, we put them into a clinical type mindset. So for example, how do you get students to really think about swallowing? So one of the things we do is we say, okay, in your practice, you're going to be in a room with an adult patient, and then you're going to have to feed this person. And you're going to be in a modified barium swallow study, or you're going to be in a feed study, and you're going to have to feed this person. You're going to have to walk over to the person and spoon some applesauce into their mouth. These are women between the ages of 22 and sometimes into their 50s, you know, but most of them, when was the last time they fed anybody? And us as speech pathologists, we take this as second nature. You know, I'm talking to the patient, I'm throwing a towel over them, I'm telling them what I'm going to do, I'm mixing the food, I'm putting the right amount of food on my spoon. I'm not awkward about how I approach the patient and put this on the patient's mouth, because it's such a learned thing I do as I talk, as I watch the swallow, all these things. The students don't have that basic skill set. They don't even know it's okay to ask for permission and touch a patient. They don't know that it's okay to say to them, I'm going to just put my hand on your throat, and how to do that, what pressure to give. So we do that kind of hands-on. And then when we start talking about, is a swallow delayed? All of a sudden, they're like, okay, well, now I know why I'm, you know, potentially putting my hand on this person's neck. And it's the same thing with the, I think what you said about really a hands-on activity. My first semester of teaching this, it was to the second years. So I had students I knew really well. And one of my kind of very, very strong student that did amazing in every clinical placement we put her in. I knew she had seen a lot of trach and vents patients when she was in her first semester. And so we go to start the trach class. And the first activity I had them do is I just gave them basically like a cartoon drawing of the anatomy of the body, of the upper respiratory system. And I said, I want you to take a crayon, a pen, and draw where the air goes when you breathe in. Now draw where the air goes when you breathe out. Now draw what happens when we put a trach tube in there. Draw where the air goes in and goes out. Now I could stand in front of the, I could lecture all that anatomy to them. It goes in handed. But there's one student who's sitting there, does the drawing, and she came up to me after class and she said, that was amazing. She said, I thought I understood it, but until I made myself go through the motions of drawing those lines, not you drawing them, but me drawing them, she said, now I really get what's happening with a cuff trach, a cuffless trach, and what's finally happening and why a speaking valve works. But she needed that kind of in the moment, like reminder and hands-on to really embrace the content. And I think that this is why we should start students in a master's program with exposure to this, because this is a really complex understanding. And it affects our voice, it affects our smell, it affects our taste, it affects our swallow. And you have to really be able in your mind's eye to understand what's happening in the upper airway when you're breathing in and out, and when you put a trach in, and when you put a speaking valve on, because you're going to be in a room explaining this to a patient, explaining it to a family member that is still in the space of, I can't believe they do this to people. You know, so you really have to get them to accept it and own it. And I think that's what we strive to do in these classes.
And I think you're touching on a really important point, because historically, I'll put it that way, speech language pathologists went through programs and it was pretty rare that they would have exposure to trach and, well, let's say this, rare they'd have exposure to medical speech pathology, and almost never had exposure to trach and vent. And it was just very, very limited. And there were a lot of questions that would arise about how do I get competencies? And even what you're talking about would help in getting competencies for SLPs who may already be past a master's program. When you're talking about kind of that, the drawing of the anatomy to get a better, understanding and being able to problem solve and critically think their way through, a patient case study. And so I think it's important even for SLPs who are maybe past the master's program, but ideally for our SLPs moving forward to have competencies in the areas that they need and coming out of graduate programs and all, I think it's critical that they get that medical speech pathology background, because it is very different than what we see in other settings as far as, like school-based speech pathology services compared to medical-based speech pathology services, like in an acute care setting to a school, that what we provide and how we do that's very different. And the students need an understanding of both. So the fact you've been able to incorporate that is really, really interesting. I think that what you're describing really lends itself to having students come out with much better backgrounds, more competency, and ideally more comfort, being more comfortable going into that setting and even getting started, because the learning hasn't stopped, but their level of confidence and their comfort to go into those areas and see those patients is probably much higher than what you would see without that background.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, a lot of students kind of have the goal in mind. And I understand that, they want to get done. And sometimes they'll walk into some of these classes that we provide and are mandatory. This isn't an elective in our program. You have to take it. And there can be a sense of, well, why I want to work in the school population. Why do I need to take this? We also have a class on head and neck cancer, and it's an intense class, and it's taught by a wonderful woman at MUSC, a speech pathologist, Julie Blair, that does an excellent job. And some of the students were a little overwhelmed with just even in their radar that this can happen to people and how devastating head and neck cancer can be. And in talking to some of the students, there was a little bit of this, well, why do I need this? And I remember saying to students, especially about bringing it back to trachs and vents, first of all, you don't know if you're working with children in an environment, if you're working in, many times these children have chronic trachs and you may come across that. But if you don't in your practice, understanding the upper respiratory tract and how voice and swallowing happens at a really basic level in order to understand the mechanics of something like a trach or speaking valve, that will inform you to understand when you have a child sitting in front of you that has a hoarse voice. It's all information that informs you. And I think your other point that was really interesting, and one of the things I think why I went back and got my PhD, was I really loved the teaching aspect of with other SLPs. I was in a position at my last place that I worked that I did, I volunteered to do a lot of the teaching, check off of competencies. You know, are you competent to, you know, when we'd hire someone new, are you competent to do a modified, a fees? And then also, are you competent to do, you know, place a speaking valve as well, both on a trach and also in line. And I remember one time I had this wonderful SLP that, like you're saying, had years of experience. She had stepped out of working full-time for a while when she had children. Now she was back in. She was great, really just a wonderful speech pathologist, but she had no experience with trachs and vents. And I took her to the bedside to do a pacemira valve. And of course, we walked through all the steps. She had watched me do several. But in that moment, you're face-to-face with the patient. So you have to handle that clinical interaction while your mind is going about, how do I open this valve? How do I keep it clean? What's the deal with the suctioning? All these aspects that you're trying to juggle. And she was trying to just do an upper airway patency test. So just simply put her finger on the hub of the trach in order to test that the person had airway patency. And we had talked about it, and I'm watching her do it. And in her nervousness, she occluded the trach both on inhalation and exhalation. So I just kind of gently went over to and kind of tapped her shoulder and said, just remember, just exhalation. And I knew she knew it, but in the moment, there was a moment there. And of course, she was a little embarrassed to have not remembered that. But I was like, I'm asking you to do all this new stuff with a patient and probably a family member standing there. So teaching that competency always made me feel that it's not about you don't know that and I do. It's about I want to give you my knowledge so you can succeed. And that's kind of my attitude with the students is it's not about me being a gatekeeper of knowledge. It's about making sure that when we finish this class, you have at least the basics so that you can ask the right questions. And if nothing else, understand where safety is a primary issue that we have to remember not how to cross that line. So those are some of the things I really kind of focus on.
And I think that's, again, a really valid point. And I know when I was a professor, that was my focus. I would tell the students sometimes, look, I want you to go out and practice and be a competent SLP. That's right. Why I'm covering what I'm covering or having you do what I have you do. You know, that was the whole design behind the program. So I think it's great that you're incorporating that from the very beginning of their entry into a master's program, because that's going to have much more of a positive effect for them to have done it throughout the entire master's program. How many placements do your students have while they're in the master's?
Like I said, they all go into an adult acute care placement their first semester. They go in one day a week during that semester. And if, you know, people ask us, well, how will they get enough hours? But I think most traditional programs will just put you in a clinic with one patient or one client. So they do that first. And then in their springs. And the other thing we do is we have lockstep progression. So we purposely match their content, their course content to where they are. So that first semester, like I said, they'll get trachs and vents is one course, but they'll have dysphagia, aphasia, and then cognitive communication, which is basically like TBI type issues. So all patients they're going to see. And then their second semester in the spring, they're mostly in, again, adult placement. So whether it be rehab hospitals, nursing homes, or outpatient. So again, they're still seeing adults. And in that semester, we pair that with voice, motor speech disorders. We also do an assessment class. And then I'm also teaching a class that we call patient care management. And we're kind of revamping that class to be a little bit more informed about the medical patient and a little bit more touching on how SLPs interweave kind of counseling and education into their practice. And then we fade into the summer, which is the students go, a majority of them go into a pediatric acute care position, or they go into outpatient pediatric And then in that semester, they take all their child language and all their, Artic and phonology, because they're getting introduced to children. And then in the fall of that first semester of their second year, they're in the schools, and now they're getting a course that's focused a lot on autism. They're getting a course that's craniofacial, and we've switched this, so it'll be craniofacial and pediatric swallowing, because those kind of go along. And then they have a couple other classes that kind of mirror their exposure to schools, but we lessen their classes down a little bit for that fall because they're in the schools typically at least 2 days a week. And then in their fifth semester, they're in we kind of call it pick your own adventure. And we try to place them where now after four semesters, they feel their interest is. And they can do that in the Charleston area, or we have some students leave our area and go to placements outside of our area. And then in their summer, where our second years are now, they're in a 5-day externship. And we have students in Charleston. We have a student in Chicago, we have three students in Colorado. So they really spread out. We have a student in Texas. And we give them that option because the likelihood that they will find a CFY, we feel, is higher if they have some experience in the geographic location they want. So like one of our students went out to Texas for this externship, and she has actually been offered a CFY in that hospital that she did her externship in. So that doesn't always work, but we feel like that's advantageous.
Well, another advantage, I think, to the program you just described is students often don't have a clear picture of where they want to work, what setting. And as you said, since they have those kind of small intros with the 1 day a week in the first semester, and each semester they're getting exposure to an area, then your pick your own adventure semester becomes much easier, because then by then, hopefully they've formed whether or not they'd rather be in a medical setting or a school setting, nursing home. You know, they probably have a much better idea of what they want their future to look like, you know, where they want to work.
And I think so. I think they're more informed. I mean, many of them are still like, I'm not sure I want to do everything. But yes, some of them have said, I just love working with adults, or children are just really where I'm in a happy place. But it lets them have that exposure. And I think the idea that you're taking content classes that are in, you see in your clinical placement is so fabulous, because like the first year I taught the aphasia class, but I still teach the cognitive communication class, and I'd be like describing, you know, early stages of a TBI and what's happening anatomically and physiologically. And the students would be like, oh, I saw someone that did this, this, and this, or I was wondering why they kept repeating, where am I? And all of a sudden they have their own stories to kind of blend into the content that I'm teaching. And I feel like that just, it makes it more relevant. Now they can go back into the clinic and be like, so why did that happen? And then I know I can go back to class and ask, why didn't they get that right? So I think that's one of the things I really, really like about this as well.
Yeah. So when you're working with these students in trach and vent, kind of focusing on that for a moment, you mentioned like them being competent and some of the things that they do in their training. What is your final kind of checkoff? What skills do you want students to be able to demonstrate?
Well, basically the one I really focused on these first two times I taught it was, I really felt that I would do like a multiple choice question for the basic anatomy and the basic physiology of the upper airway. But what I really did was a checkoff on a speaking valve evaluation. I feel like this is really concrete. Like if you don't understand why you need to make sure if it's a cuff or cuffless trach, you can't check that box when you're doing an evaluation. So you can ask these questions or pose these questions in lots of ways. But if I give you, so one of the exercises we did is I gave a case study. So here's the patient's history. And then I gave a narrative of how the case, how the patient presented. And then I think in one situation, I verbally described, in another one, I kind of wrote it out, what the SLP did. And I asked the students to review this in a group and identify the mistakes. What did the person forget? What did they do wrong? What did they not document? And then they had to critically, I'm telling you, there's mistakes, go find them. And so this was a teaching method, because it's like, oh, well, this looks good. But now I'm saying, no, there's something wrong here. Search harder until you find it. And then, you know, then I wanted to see them write out a report. And I review it. Now, just for the sake of trying to, you know, grade 40 reports, I did make it very like a rubric and very, you know, almost like a checklist, so mm-hmm. that I could quickly scan where the problems were. But I thought it was really important for the students to be able to do summarize. So the assessment statement, make a statement. This is a 49-year-old male, status post, a trach, secondary to respiratory failure. Current trach is this, they have, you know, a cuffless six, passive mirror valve was placed, however, patient unable to produce voicing, will follow up in 1 to 2 days, contact ENT if this persists, you know, like, why did you come to that? Why did you leave this out? Why did you do this? So when they have to make the narrative is when I get to see if they really put the pieces together. Mm-hmm. And I find that forcing them to write the narrative on their own, I want them to learn in the group where it's a safe place to ask questions, but I have to have a written narrative individually so that I can see where the piece they're missing. And then I take those individual narratives anonymously and do a class on what was really well stated and what was not quite there. And I tell them throughout all my classes, you know, steal this content in essence. Think about if you come across an SLP that has just written something that just is so well described, let that inform how you write it. We don't have mm-hmm. to create the recipe every time. Think about how well that's written, then you write it that way. And a lot of times I can tell them, keep these notes, keep, and when you go into clinical practice, refer to these. Oh, that was a good way to say that. That was a, you know, a very succinct way to get my message across. So I'm going to take a part of that phrase that I really like and use it. And with that, they see not only the feedback that they need as students, but they see the relevance of it. I'm adding to their clinical toolbox of, oh, I don't know what to say. I don't know how to summarize this. Well, remember, you had an example. Go back to that if you find yourself working in this situation. So that kind of bringing it down to a, it's a useful class. It's not just this kind of cerebral thing I think about. I try mm-hmm. to do as much as possible.
Well, I think what you're touching on is true for anybody seeking to get competencies in this area. Being able to identify the key pieces of information. And you said a couple of them, you know, knowing, I mean, even in the basics, is the trach cuffed or uncuffed? Is the, what size is the tracheostomy tube?
Right.
And this day and age, you need to know what brand the tracheostomy tube is, because one, that impacts size, but it also impacts the material it's made out of, the type of inner cannula it has, whether it even has an inner cannula, because some mm-hmm. brands, you know, are single lumen. And then, you know, just being able to get those bits and pieces. And I think you bring a nice idea of that, of illustrating it, because if you write out the case scenario, you don't just think it, but, you know, you write out from top to bottom, starting with this, you know, a 48-year-old male status post, you know, whatever you're going to go right. on with that history, really does help you check the boxes and make sure you've gotten all the pieces, you know, mm-hmm. that you have all of the pertinent information. I share with people all the time, the history can tell you so much about the patient and the preparation. I said, if you've got a patient who's had a trach, more than likely they were intubated at some point. And so you have to understand what intubation does. And then you also want to know, did they ever self-extubate? Mm-hmm. Because that's going to be a whole nother level of potential. Not necessarily, you may not see a problem from it, but they have that higher risk because right. of that self-extubation of having vocal fold injury, paresis, paralysis, something going on, some sort of trauma or edema, you know, because of that self-extubation. And being prepared to find that information and piece the puzzle together, you mm-hmm. know, and have all of those little bits really does help. So I think you sharing that you have the students do that is actually relevant to anyone, you know, working in this patient population. You want to go through those same steps.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So that was that's really nice. I appreciate that. One last question, because we're unfortunately running out of time, but how do you encourage or train even the students to have that level of critical thinking that you want to see, you know, as someone's moving along in this field?
You know, I think about this a lot because, I talk a lot to the other faculty about this because we have to make them critical thinkers. You know, it's not just about here's the knowledge and I know this, and because especially every situation I've ever worked in, you have to think through things and be comfortable with that. So I think one of the keys is to create an environment for the students where they feel safe to ask questions. I think at times in my practice, when I was maybe not as confident as I am now, you know, and just didn't have as much experience, I was more intimidated by what you know versus what I know. I think now I realize that I learn best in an environment where I felt safe to say to someone, I didn't get that, or I can't make that connection. And especially like the story I told about this one student who's a very, very bright, she's going to be when I met her, when she walked in the door, I thought, oh my gosh, you could be a speech pathologist right now. She just was really very in tune, learned extraordinarily quickly. But I realized she felt safe enough to come to me and be like, oh my, I didn't really get this. I saw all these patients. I never really understood it. So I think creating an environment, not only between the instructor and the students, that allows you to feel safe to say, I don't get it, but also amongst the students themselves, they have to trust each other. And I think one of the byproducts of our program is that it's a pass-fail on all our courses. And we did that because we wanted to go clinically competency rather than them worry about grades. But one of the byproducts of that is our students have told us that it takes a lot of the competition out of the class. So you can ask that question that you're not sure about and not show kind of that I don't know things. And then I think you've got to challenge them, because I feel like a lot of times they look at me and they nod their head like, I know exactly what you're talking about. But if I don't push the envelope for them to show me that, then I don't really know that. So we try, and it's labor intensive, we try to do checkoffs or activities that require the student, and it can be intimidating, to present to us their knowledge. So what we do at the end of this semester is we incorporate swallowing, the neuro language, and the cognitive communication, and we write case studies, and we have the student as their final present a case to us based on a narrative. And this year, what I propose to do, because these first year students will have been exposed to trach and vents, is weave trach and vents into those case studies. So they're going to have to demonstrate that they can think on their feet after being given all this information. They can think on their feet, well, oh, wait, if he has a trach, this could affect the swallowing. And I have to consider that. And, oh, I didn't think about that. And when they do their final, they're in a room with just a couple of the faculty. And we're not like, oh, you got that or you didn't get that. We're like, I'm asking you to think about this. Let's talk this out so I can get over that hurdle. And I hope that helps that.
One piece that I see missing sometimes, and that maybe you're getting at by having a more receptive environment for questions is knowing how to ask a question.
Yeah.
Because that's something that I think sometimes people leave out the detail, or they don't present the question in a way that even the listener can guide them the way they want to be guided. And so if you're setting up that kind of environment, hopefully they're also learning just even how to ask questions. So just to give a quick example, I'll get a question sometimes and it'll just say, can my patient with a trach use a valve? And that's the entire question. And I'm like, well, I need a little more information than just my patient. Like, you know, and you have to go through, and I'm actually helping. I ask a lot of questions back, trying to help them think through and process that patient, you know, and it sounds like that's what you're doing with your case studies, and then having that environment that allows those questions and to be able to kind of process through and think through what they're going to do or what they think they would do with a patient. So right. It sounds wonderful.
Yeah. And I think it was a funny moment in my class, because the students, you know, I don't know if I have this year, but because they see me a lot, I teach a lot of the classes. So the comfort level is pretty comfortable by the time they're in their second years. And I had written this case study I gave an example, and it was like your typical patient, an acute care patient has, you're given the speaking valve evaluation on a cuffless trach, and they're good to go. They're talking up a storm. You've trained staff, you've trained the family, and you come by, you know, after the patient's been doing this for a week or two. So you're real comfortable that the patient is tolerating this, no concerns. And you stop by to check on them, and they're laying in bed, and the valve is on their trach, and they're asleep, and their wife is sitting in the room also sleeping. And, you know, we say, oh, you can't have that valve on when you're sleeping, right? You know, we tell them this. So I had an example of that. And what the answer to the question was, the speech pathologist should go in and remove the speaking valve and, you know, just remind, this is not the best thing to do. You don't need it while you're sleeping. It should just be removed. Obviously, the person can tolerate it, and it's a good indicator they're probably pretty close to some kind of weaning. But we teach, and we should, to cover the more acute patient, don't sleep in this. And the student read all this, and because she was in a safe place, she raised her hand and she said, so I'm confused. Do you wait until they're asleep to take the speaking valve off? I remember I stood up there and I thought, how in the world did you put those two things together? But that's what you have to let them ask you. You're like, if she walked out of my classroom and somehow had connected that, what was I teaching? So I just thought it was so, and I just laughed out loud and said to her, I am so glad you could ask me that. And so let's go over that. So I think that's what we have to do. And that's what we do when we teach clinically. This is our coworker. I want to make sure you know what I know so you can do this well. And that's how I think we have to kind of see our students, get them up to that level.
Well, I'm excited you came on to share what you're doing in your program, because I think it's a unique and very interesting way to approach the training for the students, for future speech language pathologists. And I'm excited to hear about it. I personally have always hoped for more medical speech pathology based programs, because that's my area of love. Mm-hmm. And I taught a number of courses in that. Well, all of my courses were medical speech pathology based when I was a professor, but it wasn't the focus of the program. That was right. You know, just what I taught. And most of them were electives. So it was only those students, you know, who really had an interest. So the fact that you've been able to help, that your university is developing that program, your department is developing that program, and that you're able to incorporate so many great ways of training, it's just great.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be a part of it. I mean, I feel really lucky that I was, chosen to be in this group of amazing faculty that I work with. So yeah, it's kind of a dream job in terms of that. So,
well, thank you for coming on and sharing it. Because I think, you know, what we talked about, it's not only your program, but you talked about some of the steps to competencies, how people can become better critical thinkers and some of the pieces that they need to learn for trach and vent, you know, and kind of where to start. So I think there's some really good information in here, and that your students are getting it early is a bonus. They're mm-hmm. lucky to be in your program.
Well, thank you. I mean, I think they'll need, it's not like they're going to walk out and be competent. Right. They're going to need exposure and more coursework and just more clinical practice, but mm-hmm. it's a good start, I hope.
It is. And to have that foundational knowledge that, like I said earlier on, they'll be more comfortable. Mm-hmm. You know, they won't feel, it won't be as scary to try and step into that world.
Right. Right. That's what I'm hoping for. Yeah. Right. Excellent.
Well, thank you so much for joining me today.
It was a pleasure. I really enjoyed it, Kristen. It was a nice conversation, and I'm glad you asked me. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CAM. We are happy to offer continuing education credit through ASHA for this podcast. To receive credit, please go to www.passymuir.com/podcast and click on the continuing education link under this episode. Then you will either create an account or log into your existing education portal account. Complete the quiz and course evaluation for your podcast episode. Your certificate will be available for download once completed.